And we're holding on page Chof Hei in Yeromus, Ha'ish Shalom Perek Hamishasar, middle of Ois Nunhid. The last two prakim of Yeromus deal with a lot of issues where a woman claims that her husband has died, or we have possible evidence that her husband is dead, and what that means in terms of her being allowed or not allowed to remarry. The parak is called Ha'isha Shalom because it begins with a case for Isha, a woman and her husband went overseas when there's Shalom between them and Shalom in the world, and she comes and says her husband is dead, then we have reason, we may have reason to believe her. She's not, there was no war that she might mistakenly think that he was killed in the war. There was no argument between them that she might be trying to get out of a bad marriage, and then it goes through various other scenarios like that. Anyway, at the end of the parak, it deals with a case where she's claiming that her husband has died and there's yibum involved. So, or various other scenarios like that involving where there could be yibum involved. There can also be a case where she's receiving a get, which would preclude yibum. So part of the question basically comes down to, is yibum likely to be something she would want, or is it something she'd be more likely to avoid? Where therefore, like, she might make false claims in order to make it possible, even though it shouldn't be, or whatever. Anyway, so the Gemara brings up the point, what happens, now we know there's a concept, zachen la'adam shalai b'fonav. You can give somebody something through a third party, and as long as it's a benefit for him, then that works, even if he hasn't explicitly said that he wants it. But what about now on the other hand, when it comes to being mazaka get to a man being mazaka get through a third party to his wife is not necessarily going to work because she doesn't want that get. It's not a schus for her. Generally, it's a choiva. But Ravina asks, mazaka get le'ishtoi b'mokum k'tata mahu. What about if there had been fights between them? What if they weren't having shalom bias? Then if he wants to grant a get to her and give it to a third party who will be zoicha in it on her behalf, will that work? Given the islak like tatabada, since he and she are fighting, zchusullah, then you can argue maybe it's a zchus, maybe it is a good thing, she does want out of such a marriage, and therefore it would be an example of zachem la'on shalai b'fanav. Or maybe after all, maybe she would prefer to stay put where she is and not be divorced. So, after all, there may be some benefit in the marriage, even if they're not getting along. The reason the Gemara is bringing this in is because the Gemara tries to relate it before in the part that's not here in Ein Yaakov. It tries to relate it to the case of the Mishnah about whether she wants Yibum or not. Anyway, Toshma, the Omer is Shlokish, so we can prove because we have an expression. The Shlokish says, there's an expression that women have, tav lemes of tandu, it's better to live as two bodies, milemes of almalu, than to sit and to live as an almana. So in other words, a woman would rather be married, even if her husband is not such a great guy, rather than be single. You it has Reb Levi? I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's Reish Lakish, but I don't know. Maybe it's Reb Levi. Okay, I don't know. By me, it just says Reish Lamed. Anyway, Tav Lameis of Tandum, Lameis of Armalu, it's better to be living as married, as two bodies, than to be alone. So therefore, in other words, even if her husband is not such a catch, then nevertheless, she'd still rather be married to him. So therefore, that would show that it's a choiva, not a schus, for her to receive a gift. Abaya Omer, Abaya says another expression in the same vein. Dishum shemona gavra, even if her husband is like an ant, so he's short, like an ant, small, like an ant, kursa bechauta romula, nevertheless, kursa, her chair, bechauta romula, she will place for herself among the noble woman. In other words, she'll say to herself, my husband may be an ant, he may be a very little nothing of a guy, but nevertheless, I'm married and therefore I deserve to sit with the important noble women.
He's got a big neshama,
maybe, yeah. In fact, Ben Yoyada points out, I mean, if we just wanted to talk about his small size, then we could use a different kind of bug as the analogy for it. Why Dafka an ant?
Right, he's a kosher bug.
There are very few kosher bugs, but still. He says, anyway, the point is, the point is, he says that we find in Mishlei that the ant is a symbol of being smart and industrious. We say to the lazy person, go look at the ant and see how hard it works preparing for the future. So in other words, we're saying, yeah, the guy may be an ant, he may be a little tiny guy, but at least, you know, he has some good quality, he's a hard worker, he's a smart, capable guy. Rapapa Amar, Rapapa says a third expression in this regard. Dinapsa Gavra, even if her husband is only a comber of wool, which is a very low class kind of job, even though he has such a low class job, Tikri b'seifi bava b'teisiv, nevertheless she will invite him to the threshold of the house and sit together with him. In other words, again, she's not embarrassed to appear in public and sit in front of her house with him. Look, I'm married, I have a husband, even though her husband is such a low class, is such a low class worker. Different way of understanding it is also Ben Yoyada explains it a little bit differently. Like she'll not sit with him in the front of the house, but like she'll sit there at the front of the house expectantly waiting for him to come home. Rav Ashi says a fourth expression that expresses this idea, the kulsa gavra, even if her husband is a kulsa, which we'll explain in a second what that means, she's still not even going to ask him for lentils for her pot, even though lentils are very cheap. In other words, she's saying, I'm willing to make do with even very little, and not to bother him even for unimportant things like that. It's so worth it to me that I'm married to him. What is a kulsa? Rashi explains, in shemetz psul b'mishpacha, there's some kind of suspicion that there's a psul of yichus in his family. So b'pashtus, in other words, Rashi is understanding kulsa, the shodesh kuf lamed samach, we often find in the Gemara, we find it sometimes as meaning to make fun of someone. We find in the Tanakh, it's used as a word kalosa, for example, in other words, from that shodesh mean to make fun of someone, to mock them publicly. Actually, in Gemara terminology, very often it means the opposite. It means to praise somebody. So maybe the common thing is talking a lot about somebody, whether for praise or the opposite. Whatever the case, her husband is not such a great guy, but nevertheless, in terms of his yichus, nevertheless, she'd still rather be married to him, and she's proud of being married to him. Ben Yehoyada gives a different explanation of it. The kulsa over here might actually mean a robber. Kulsa also has a meaning having to do with being armed with a helmet and weapons. So therefore, even if he's that kind of guy, nevertheless, she's proud to be married to him. Now, why do we have four different expressions over here? The Orach HaNer points out, because there might be four different reasons why a person might be embarrassed of their spouse. It might be because it's not such a great marriage. It might be they're not having shalom bias. They're like two bodies instead of they really ought to be like one body. It could be because her husband is physically unattractive, like the aunt. It could be because he has a low class degrading job, like the wool comber. Or it could be because of a matter of mishpacha, like Rashi's explanation of kulsa. No matter what, she's saying, after all said and done, it's still better to be married than to be single. There is, by the way, so the Gemara continues. Tana, we learn in a b'raisa, v'chulin mizanis v'tolus v'alehem. All these types of women actually do have an advantage, even if they have something to be embarrassed of their husband. There is the point, on the other hand, they're able to commit znus and then claim, if they have children from it, that it's from their husband. So in other words, their having a husband, if nothing else, gives them cover for such kinds of things. Rav Moshe Feinstein, now the question is, why would he say such a thing? I mean, a woman's going to be married only for that reason. So Rav Moshe Feinstein actually has a fascinating tshuva on a question. There was a woman who was not Shemeres Torah Mitzvahs. She was married. She and her husband met after the war and got married, Chuppah V'Kiddushin and all that. To make a long story short, eventually her husband tells her that he had actually shmadzich a few years earlier, Rachman al-Tzlan. And she says, in that case, I want out. So the question was brought to Rav Moshe in that case. Is that a valid reason to say that maybe the Kiddushin were never valid in the first place? You wouldn't have married the guy if she had known that he's a Meshumer. So he goes among the various points brought in that Shuva is our Gemara over here. So Rav Moshe says, listen, if we're talking about an Isha Ksheira, then obviously she's not getting married in order to provide a cover for Znus. If she's a woman who's anyway Perutza, then also she doesn't need that kind of cover. She'll just go and do it anyway. We're talking about the average kind of woman who would rather be married, and nevertheless, though, she does have a Yetzirah after all, and she might use it as a cover for such activities. So therefore, that gets into the question then, in this case, would we say all of these expressions about this woman in this case, that she would rather be married even to a no good nick of a husband rather than be single, would that necessarily apply? It might indeed not, and maybe there would be reason to say that she wouldn't have married him if she knew what kind of guy he was. Fine. Ha'isha Basra Perek Shisha also. So now you have the last Perek in Ar Masechta, which is because you have three Perekim in Ar Masechta that all begin with the word Ha'isha, so they have to be distinguished in various ways. The previous, they have Ha'isha Rabba, Ha'isha Shalom, and Ha'isha Basra, the last Perek called Ha'isha. So again, most of the perek deals with dinim about where a woman comes and says that her husband has died, or that he divorced her, or that she's potter from yibum because she had a child in the densayam, and all kinds of different permutations like that about what kinds of claims are believed and what are not. So eventually it gets into the question more generally of a person disappears, what kind of evidence do we need to establish that he's dead?
The woman has a child, she's potter from yibum.
She's potter from yibum, yeah. The whole point is, if she and her husband had a child, then the whole point is that it's only when the husband is childless. Yeah.
That's just come by herself, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. Okay, so as I said, so the end of the perek deals a lot with the various dinim about somebody has disappeared, what kind of evidence is needed to establish that he's dead so that his wife should be able to remarry. Anybody who's ever read, for example, Marcus Lehmann's story Out of the Depths remembers the whole plot point is over there that the guy has disappeared and they find a body dressed in his clothes and carrying his wallet, and they think it's him, but the Rav explains that it's not based on this Gemara, and eventually Taka, the original husband, turns up. So yeah, anyway. So the Mishnah says, in the Eden Ela parts of Ponim in Achotim v'Chola, when you find a body, you can give Eders only if you see the appearance of the face, meaning primarily primarily that means the forehead and the nose. So if you don't, and then based on that, you'll be able to recognize that it's him, as opposed to if you can't identify those parts, then that's not necessarily enough evidence to allow his wife to remarry. How it is nowadays with DNA and all that kind of thing is a whole other matter. After September 11th, for example, there were rabbonim all over the world dealing with issues involving that. After other disasters and terrorist attacks and whatnot, where there was no body left b'chlal. But anyway, yeah. So the Gemara says, "Tana rabbanan, padachas b'leparts of ponim." If we're able to see the forehead. But we don't have the pouts of ponim, we don't have the rest of the appearance of the face, and in particular the nose, or pouts of ponim bolei padachas, ein eden. On that basis, we cannot say eidos that this is the guy, and therefore that he's dead. Ad shiu shneim, you have to actually, pouts of ponim means the rest of the appearance of the face, meaning like the cheeks and so forth. Imachotem, ad shiu shneim, you have to have both of them, the forehead and the cheeks and all, imachotem together with the nose. So basically you need the entire face. Omer Abayevi, Temer of Kahana, Mikra, where's a pasuk that expresses that point, an expression, and the pasuk is Hakoras Pnehem on Sabam. The recognition of their face has testified against them. In context, the Nabi is talking about, you have people who are brazenly doing Averis, and like you look at them and you can see it on their face, they're doing Averis, but the point, the expression Hakoras Pnehem suggests this idea that you can recognize Hakoras only through Pnehem, only through their complete face, not the rest of the body. The Gemara, by the way, also deals with various other things. What if you have, for example, a particular birthmark or wart on the body which is recognizable as being his? Is that enough evidence? And there's a whole complicated sugya on the subject. B'chlal, you have also the simen, by the way, in Shulchan Aruch, the simen in Eben Ezer, and then in simen Yud Zayin that deals with these dinim is one of the longest single simonim in Shulchan Aruch, especially with all the Noisa Kalim, because there are all kinds of different permutations and possibilities, and then things that that Rabbanim will try every possible way to be able to be matir and aguna. There's a famous expression that the Rishonim bring, that if a Rav is able to be matir and aguna api alocha, then it's considered as though he rebuilt one of the destroyed buildings of Yerushalayim. So Rabbanim throughout all the ages have put in whatever every effort they could to be able to say that we have enough evidence to be able to declare that the guy is taka dead so his wife can remarry. Anyway. So the Gemara tells a story in this connection to illustrate this point that unless you have the complete face, you won't always recognize a person. Abba bar Marta, the who Abba bar Manyumi, Abba bar Marta, otherwise also known as Abba bar Manyumi, so it's possible that Marta was his mother's name and Manyumi was his father's name, and he went by both. Anyway, have a maskebe de Beresh Kalusa Zuzi. He owed money, he was being dunned for money by the members of the family of the Resh Kalusa. The Resh Kalusa we've talked about before was the governor of the Jews in Babel, who's a descendant Ben Achaben of David HaMelech, and he had tremendous political and executive power in the Jewish community in Babel. Anyway, so this Abba bar Marta, Abba bar Manyumi, owed them money, and they're hassling him for it. Icy Kira, so he took some wax, Dovak Bivliyasa, he stuck it onto a worn out rag of a worn out cloth rag, Dovak bar Pusei, and he stuck that onto his forehead. Cholof Kamaihu, and then afterwards he walked in front of these people from the Reish Kolos's household, Veloy Ishtemoide, or Bashkuruha, and they didn't recognize him, but Ishtemoide literally means know him, Bashkuruha means recognize him. So you see that without seeing the forehead, you can't recognize a person even if you have the rest of the face. Why did he do it? Ah, so Anaf Yosef points out, I mean, what are you going to say? He's a Talmud Chacham we're talking about over here. Was he trying to evade a debt? So he says that what it must have been is he taka couldn't afford to pay, and yet they're hassling him for it. And halacha is that when you know a person doesn't have what to pay, then you're not allowed to do that. Loisiela kenosha, the Torah says. But we often find in the Gemara that the Rosh Galusa themselves with tzaddikim, sometimes not, but the servants who worked in their households a lot of times were no goodniks. So therefore, these servants or other members of the household are pressuring him to pay when they know good and well that he doesn't have. So therefore, in that case, under the circumstances, he's entitled to use this kind of disguise to evade them.
He
owed them money, and now he disguised himself so he could get away, so they wouldn't bother him when he passed by them.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, like a mask, kind of, yeah. Reuven Margolius actually has a slightly different take on it. He says we find in various places in Shas that Talmid Chachamim are supposed to be exempted from various kinds of taxes. Here, the members of the Reish Galus's household were not granting him that exemption. They were treating him as though he's a regular person and owes the taxes, and therefore he's entitled to evade them by putting on this disguise in order that they won't recognize him. By the way, the Yerushalmi here tells a somewhat similar story involving Jews in Eretz Yisrael, where there was a period when the Romans were persecuting and then killing them. So the Gemara, the Yerushalmi describes over here that there were people in the city of Tzipori in particular who were doing a similar kind of thing. They put on basically fake noses made out of wax. With the same idea, as the Mishnah is saying over here, if you don't see the nose, you're not going to fully recognize the person. And it worked for a while, and unfortunately some Moslem realized who they were and then turned them over to the government, and they were killed. Al Kiddush Hashem. But we see, the point is, in other words, when you don't see the whole face, you don't necessarily always recognize a person. All right. Now, further on, it goes and talks about like this. Suppose that a person drowns, Rahman al-Islam. Now, if you find the body, then fine, you know, you can recognize the body, hopefully, that you have dinim about that, how long after it's brought out of the water, is it still considered that it will be intact, etc., various dinim in that. But then you also have, what if you don't find the body? Now, on the one hand, you could say, look, a person can't live underwater for very long. On the other hand, you have, if it's a large enough body of water, he might have gotten out someplace else, out of your sight. So the Mishnah and the Gemara describe there's a difference between what's called Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Soif and Mayim She'in Lahem Soif. Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Soif is a body of water that's small enough that you can see all the edges of it, all the circumference of it from your vantage point. So then in that case, all you have to do is wait there long enough. You see a guy fell in there and you don't see him surface after a certain amount of time, then you can assume that he's dead. And even though you didn't find the body, because how long could he live underwater? And if he had gotten out from under the water, you would have seen him. But if it's Mayim She'ein Lahem Soif, it's a larger body of water, you can't do that, because as the Gemara is going to give some examples over here, then he might have actually managed to make it out alive. Again, by the way, you do have, for example, when the Titanic sank, where there were Jews on board, and there were big shilas, obviously the Atlantic Ocean is Mayim She'ein Lahem Soif, so there were big shilas about not very many of the bodies were recovered, so what kind of evidence do we have to be matir their wives? There were also big shilas that were dealt with at that time about whether there's any way to be matir them. One point I think that was brought up is nowadays with modern communications, or as modern as they had in 1912, the guy is not necessarily going to be able to disappear for very long. Sooner or later, you're going to find out what happened to him. And therefore, if you don't, then you have maybe reason to say that his wife is mutter to remarry. But again, it's complicated. But yeah. Okay. So the Gemara tells, "Hahu gavra d'tova ba'agma d'samki." There was a man who drowned in agma d'samki. Agma means the swamp. D'samki is the name of a place. So this is, Rashi points out that it's a swamp, it's stagnant water, it's not a river or something like that. Insiv, Rabshil, Ansiv, Rabshil, Ludevesu, and Rabshila gave a heter to his wife to get remarried, even though they couldn't find his body. Omale Rav the Shmuel, but Rav says to Shmuel, how could Rabshila do that? We say clearly in the Mishnah that when the guy, that when it's Mayim She'im Lahem Soif, there's no heter. So Rav says to Shmuel, Tana Shamte, come, we should put him in Cherem for disobeying what it says in the Mishnah. Amalei, but Shmuel says, hold on, Nishalach Leberesha, first let's send him a message and see what he was thinking. Shochulei, so they sent him a message. Mayim she'en lahem soif, ishtas suroi metedas. So if a person drowns in Mayim she'en lahem soif, where you can't see all the edges, is his wife mutter or not? You don't find the body. Shalach Lahur, if Shila sends him back, ishtas sura. As why the wife remains also. Okay. So far, so good. So he knows the halacha. Next, they ask him, "Va'agma de samki mayim sheyesh lahem soif or she'en lahem soif?" How would you classify this agma de samki, this swamp? Shalachu mayim she'en lahem soif. So he sends him back. It's mayim she'en lahem soif. You stand in any one place, and you're not going to see all the edges of it. Nu, they ask him, "Umar my time ab de sochi?" Well, then they ask him, "So Rebbe, then why'd you do that? Why were you matir his wife to be married if you know perfectly well that the halacha is not?" So Rav Shila explains, Mita Te'ina. Actually, what it was is I made a mistake. When I classified the Agma de Samki, now I'm telling you that I realize it's Mayim She'en Lahem Soif. But originally, I classified it differently. Anos Savri, I originally thought the definition of Mayim She'yesh Lahem Soif or She'en Lahem Soif doesn't depend whether you can see all the edges. I figured, Kivin de Kovu Rokaimi, since the water there is stagnant, you don't have waves or anything in it, So I figured, even though it's a large swamp or lake, nevertheless, it could be considered like Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Soif, because like this, you might have, let's say, for example, so he fell into the water and is unconscious. If there's a current over there, then fine, the current could carry him someplace else, if there's waves or whatever. But here, he figured this place, this swamp over here, it's stagnant water. If he falls in someplace and is unconscious, the water's not going to carry him any place else, so therefore I figured that it's called Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Soif, and there would be a heter for his wife to remarry. But then I realized, Velohi, actually it's not so. Given Ik Gali, the fact is there's no current there, but there are waves over there in the sense. After all, you have there's ripples in the water, the wind blows, and there's ripples in the water. Emo Gali Ashpalua, so I realize now it's very possible that the waves carried him from one place to another in that swamp, and maybe he actually regained consciousness and got out alive. So yes, I do realize that my heter was misplaced. Well, Kori Shmuel, alei de Rav lo yo'una l'tzadik kol oven. Shmuel said, you know what? With this story, we can apply to you, Rav, what it says in the pasuk. No, lo yo'una l'tzadik kol oven. Nothing wrong or evil will befall a tzadik. In other words, Hashem helped it. Like this, you, Rav, would have inappropriately put Rav Shila in Cherem for no good reason. So now the Eishta helped that didn't happen, that we were able to find out that it wasn't that Rav Shila blatantly violated what it says in the Mishnah. He made a mistake in judgment, which fine, that's not a reason to hold it against him. Kori Rav alei de Shmuel, in turn Rav said on Shmuel, we can apply the pasuk with Shua Beroiv Yoyet. There is salvation with many advisors, meaning if I had just done it on my own, then yeah, I would have thought, let's put him in Cherem. But because you advised me, let's hold on, let's find out what's going on, then you saved me from a serious avera.
Majority opinion.
Not so much majority opinion, but the point, well, majority opinion, yeah, but the point is, in other words, that I had a sounding board that you told me to be more careful about it. A couple of interesting things about it is, after all, so what about Rav Shila is also a tzaddik? Does lo yo'una l'tzaddik kol oven not apply to him, that he gave a wrong psak in halacha? So there's a number of different explanations. First of all, b'dieved, the Gemara says, if a rov gives a heter under such conditions, even though it wasn't the right thing to do, nevertheless, b'dieved, if the woman gets married, you don't have to force her to get divorced. So in that sense, what Rav Shila did, fine, it wasn't fully in keeping with how it says and with how it says in halacha, but nevertheless, it's not. And there's an even more interesting explanation, actually, that in fact, min hashamayim, yes, the guy was dead. All it is apia halacha, we don't have enough evidence to declare him dead. But nevertheless, min hashamayim, the Eibishter knew full well that the guy is dead, and therefore he wouldn't have allowed Rav Shila to give a psak that could end up where she's going to end up getting remarried, and then her husband's going to come back alive, because so it would all work out after all. The Ben Yehoyada tells a similar story, actually involving Beis Yosef and the Mabit. There was this famous Chaver and Bar Plugta. They had many machlokas in halacha. Similar kind of thing, where there was an argument between the Beis Yosef and the Mabit about a case similar to this, about whether a woman is mutter or not. And the Beis Yosef, I think the Beis Yosef assered her, and the Mabit was matter her. Anyway, maybe it was the other way around, I don't remember. Anyway, the Beis Yosef, as we know, had a magid, he had a malach who would come and teach him Soda Satora. The Malach, this Malach explained to him, because you, Rabbi Yosef, have spent so much time studying and learning and memorizing Mishnayos, I'm the neshama of the Mishnayos that's coming to teach you. And he taught him all kinds of different secrets of Torah. Eventually, the Beis Yosef kept a diary of all these visits of the Magid, and eventually it was published as a sefer called Magid Meshorim. Anyway, this Magid tells him the same kind of thing as in this explanation over here. Yes, the guy was in fact dead. The psak that his wife is allowed to get remarried is perfectly valid. But the fact is, it's just there wasn't enough evidence in halacha, according to you or according to the Mabit, as the case may be, to actually say so. But nevertheless, you shouldn't think that either of you has actually made a mistake and was matur and eshes ish. Worth mentioning in this connection also a similar kind of story, also not involving drowning, but also involving a case where a Rav was ready to paskin that a woman is mutter to remarry, but min hashamayim it didn't happen, is during the time, you had the whole Gzeres Tachvatat, the whole Cossack invasion of Poland and Ukraine and everything, and then there were years of war after that. At one point, there was one phase of the war where the Cossacks and the Tartars and I don't know who else invaded Vilna. There was a young Talmud Chacham living there named Rabbi Yaakov Zak. He was caught by these guys, and they're lining people up, and they're executing them one after the other. His family, meanwhile, his wife and everybody else are hiding out in an attic nearby and when watching, all they can do is watch. They can't do anything. And they see, he's brought to the head of the line and then they see that they imagine they saw that his head actually was chopped off and then rolled away. So eventually the Edom managed to get away. Eventually the Edom man who saw that managed to get away from there, from Vilna. They went to the city of Holoshoy in what's now, I think, Czechia or something, whatever. The Rabbi Yaakov's wife had gotten there. Her father, or her grandfather, I don't remember, was Rabbi Heschel of Krakow, one of the great Rabbonim of those times. He was a Rebbe of the Shach and of a number of the other Gdoli Yisrael of that time. Anyway, they brought their evidence, and Rabbi Heschel said, yeah, and he says, you know, Tochter, you're allowed to remarry. We have evidence that your husband has been killed by the Tartars. She says, I don't believe it. And she refused to entertain any other shidduchim. Eventually, Rabbi Yaakov made it back. He explained what happened was when he was lying over there and about to be killed, the goy over there has a shtikor rachmonis on him. He's such a young guy, you have your whole life ahead of you. He says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to bring down my sword on your neck, but not the blade of it, which will kill you. I'll bring down the flat of my sword on your neck. So from far, from anybody else who's looking, they won't look carefully. They'll think that I killed you. Meanwhile, you go and then crawl away and hide under this wagon over here near here. And when things are safe, you'll be able to get away. Kitzer Amaita, that's how he got back. After that, Rabbi Heschel said, I'm never again getting involved in Hatoras Agunis in times like this, where who knows how many other such things could happen. This sort of Yaakov and his wife then were able to get back together. They later had a son named Rabbi Tzvi, who became the Chacham Tzvi, and their son in turn was Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who's named for his day of Yaakov Zak. So, yeah. Anyway. So, getting back to the Gemara. One more explanation, by the way, as far as why the Gemara is not so bothered that Rabbi Shila was making a mistake in halacha is fine, because after all, even if it is a mistake in halacha, it's not something that would affect him personally. But if Rav puts Rabbi Shila in cherem, the halacha is, if you put somebody in cherem who doesn't deserve it, then the person who made the cherem himself needs to be put in cherem. Then I'm unlisted among one of the 24 people who needs to. So therefore, so if Rabbi Shila, if Rav had placed Rabbi Shila in cherem inappropriately, then it would have bounced back on him. That's the kind of thing the Eibishter will save a tzaddik from. That Rav Shila himself gave a heter for a woman to remarry, even if it turns out it's incorrect, that's not so bad. All right, so the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Ashi, Hoda Amri, Rabbanan, Mayim She'en Lahem Soif, Ishtei Asura, when we say this din, that when you have Mayim She'en Lahem Soif, the man's wife is also, because you never know, he might have gotten safely out of the water, Hani Mili Be'inishta Alma. Rav Ashi says that would apply only to a regular person. Avot Tzuvim, Rabbanan Loi, but not if he's a Tamad Chacham. Edis Solik, because the Tamad Chacham is well known among the populace. Edis Solik, if he actually gets out alive, Kola Islay, there will be a coil, people will know that it's him, and eventually news will get around. But the Gemara says, Veloihi, that's not so. Loishna inishta alma, Veloishna tsurvame abonan. Doesn't matter whether it's a regular person, doesn't matter whether it's Tamat Chacham. Di'eved ein lachatchila loy, but di'eved, if his wife got remarried based on a heter, then fine, we're not going to force her to get divorced. Unless, of course, her husband does show up, and then there's all kinds of consequences that are outlined earlier in the Masechta. But lachatchila, even if her husband was a Tamat Chacham, we shouldn't rely on that kind of thing. We would have known, as long as we don't know. story in that connection, by the way, in Sipur Chassidim involving, I think it was the Chozim or the Balloon, I don't remember, some famous Rebbe, where a woman comes to him with a problem. Her husband has disappeared, and she's an Aguna. Kitzer HaMaisa, the Chozah says, I can see with Ruach HaKodesh that your husband is dead. However, we can't pass in Halacha based on Ruach HaKodesh. The fact is, we don't have evidence that will stand up in Halacha and a Beis Din to allow you to remarry. So he tells her, listen, right now you have already a little child with your husband. He says, if you accept on yourself that you're not going to look for any heterim or anything like that, you're going to accept that this is the Eibishter's will for you, then I'm benching you with Arichus Yom, and you'll have generations of children and grandchildren and whatnot from this one son. And so later on, and many years later, she meets up with some other tzaddik, and she tells him, look at this, I'm 105 years old, and I have hundreds of tzetzoyim all from that bracha. All right, the Gemara continues. Tanya, Omer Gamliel, Hama Chasuisi Mahalach Bespina. One time I was traveling on a ship. V'reisi Spina Achas Shenishbura Bayam. I saw another ship that had broken up and all the passengers were going to drown. I felt very bad about a Tamad Chacham who I knew was on that ship. And the Gemara interjects to Manu Rabbi Akiva, namely Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Gamliel knew that Rabbi Akiva was traveling on that other ship. I guess they told each other their schedules or whatever. And he felt very bad. What's going to happen to Rabbi Akiva? Ukshalisi by Yabasha, but Rabbi Gamliel says, when I came up to the dry land, when I got off the ship, Bava Yoshev Adam Lafanai Bahalacha. Who came but Rabbi Akiva himself? And he comes and sits in front of me and we start discussing Halacha. A Marty lawyer said to him, "Bni, mi helcha? Who brought you out? How did you get saved from the shipwreck?" Amali, he says, "Dach shall spin in his damenli. A plank of wood from the ship came by me. I held onto it. And every wave that came against me, ni natu leiroshi, I bent my head downward to it. In other words, instead of trying to keep my head above water, let it wash over me. But then that way, at least it'll wash over, and I'll be safe until the next wave." Mikan Omer Chachamim, based on this, the Chachamim said this is not just a advice for a person who's in a shipwreck. Im Yavoyu Rishoyim Al Adam, if Rishoyim are coming to harass a person, Yinanei Aloy Roshay, he should nod his head towards them, show a little Chachna, show a certain sense of subjugation in front of them. We have this week's parasha, Yaakov with Esav, bowing to him and all that. And that way, in other words, you stand up to them, you try to be the big tough guy. You may come out the worst for it, but you be more flexible. You'll get out safely, like Rabbi Akiva did. It means the Marsha refers over here to something he explains on Bava Basra. When you have all the famous stories of Rav Baba Chana in Bava Basra, the first story over there is about waves, about tremendous waves of how they endanger ships. And so forth, and some, among other things. It's a metaphor for all the Goyishan nations who come, so what do? At least as far as the Gashmias of things, we bend and bow our heads before them, again, like Yaakov with Esav, and we realize, you know what, this is how it is in Golos, and we have to be strong in front of them, Ruchnias, but as far as Gashmias, we realize that we have to let them have their way sometimes. So Rabbi Gamliel says to himself, Amarti Ba'os HaShah. So I said to myself at that point, Tamak Dolem Divrei Chachamim, look how great are the words of the Chachamim. Sha'amim Mayim Sheyesh Lam Seif Muteres, Mayim Shein Lam Seif Asura. Look at that. You're saying that when a man drowns, when a man has fallen into water, Sha'in Lam Seif, his wife remains Asur because he might have gotten out safely. Here you would think, V'derech HaTeva, how is a person getting out of a shipwreck? And yet we see that Rabbi Akiva was able to. So you never know, basically.
And you knew something happened. So the little girl was in the water of her mother.
What?
3 days. The whole family disappeared off the coast of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And they found her after 3 days.
Nice.
Died, but she survived.
Wow. Okay. I mean, they were in a raft or a boat or something. No, I don't know. But, yeah, okay, anyway. By the way, when we say over here daf shel sfina, that's a plank, and literally daf means a page of a ship that saved him. Famously, when Meir Shapiro started the whole concept of daf yomi, he quoted this Gemara and he says it's a daf shel sfina. It's the daily daf that a yid holds on to, and that helps him keep his head above the gashmias of the world that threatens to drown him and sink him, and helps him keep his head where it's supposed to be. So we know, as people know, we have in this shul a shir in Daf Yomi, which we've had here for over 4 years, and previously I had it in other places as well. And we should Taka be holding on to that Daf Shal Sfina. And anyway, the Gemara continues. Tanya Omer Rabbi Akiva. Then Rabbi Akiva himself tells a story. Pamachas Eisi Mahalach B'Sfina. One time I was traveling on a ship. V'Eisi Sfina Achas Shemiterefes B'Yam. Again, I saw another ship that was being tossed around in the water, so it hadn't yet sunk, but I could see that it was in danger of sinking. I was very worried about the Talmud Chacham who was on board that ship, Umanu Rameir, naming that was Rameir was on board the ship. Then Rabbi Akiva says, when I came up onto dry land in the country of Kaputkia, there's various possibilities where Kaputkia is. It might be someplace in Turkey or in Egypt, or it might be the island of Crete, whatever it is, someplace in the Mediterranean. Then Rabbi Meir comes and sits in front of me and starts discussing matters of halacha. So I asked him, my son, who got you out of the water? Amali, and he tells me, Gal Tardani La Chavere, one wave picked me up and threw me to the next wave, Vachavere La Chavere, and the next wave to the next wave, Adshiki Unili Abasha, until it threw me out on dry land. So unlike Rabbi Akiva, who at least had a plank to hold on to, here it was the waves themselves that saved Rabbi Meir and brought him. Amarti, Ba'os HaShah, said Rabbi Akiva, again said, I said at that time, Tamag Dolem Divrei Chachamim, look how great are the words of the Chachamim, Sh'amu Mayim Sh'yesh Lam Seif, Ishta Meteres, Mayim Sh'en Lam Seif, Ishta Asura. Again, you would think, B'derech HaTeva, how's your mayor going to survive that? And yet he did, because the waves in themselves brought him from one place to another. Now, one point is, Mephoshim asks, so what's Rabbi Akiva so impressed about? He himself went through the same experience. And one answer is, because of Rabbi Akiva, the ship Kaka broke up, and therefore there's a plank that he was able to hold on to. With Rabbi Meir, we didn't even see the ship breaking up. As far as he knew, Rabbi Meir has nothing even to hold on to hold him above water, and yet it all worked out. Yom Mashiach Ha'Geula, Yud Aleph Kislev. There's three places in the Torah where the Eibishter promises to take the Jewish people out of Golos Ba'achris Hayom at the end of days. Two of them are in Parshas Yitzavim. We have the pasuk to Shav Hashem Alekecha as Shavuscha, that Hashem will return all of your captives, V'kibetzcha Mikol Amim, and He'll gather you together from all the nations, V'eviyacha Hashem Alekecha Al-Oretz, and Hashem will bring you to the land. So there you have a very clear promise about Kibbutz Golias at the time of the Geula. That demonstrates that there's going to be a Geula. It doesn't demonstrate that the Geula is going to happen through Mashiach. It doesn't mention Mashiach and those Sukkim, but it shows that there is going to be a gathering of the exiles of the Jewish people and bringing them back to Eretz Yisrael. By the way, I have seen it pointed out, people have pointed out that pasuk, it's not part of the sikha over here, and let's not mix them up, but I have seen people point out that pasuk, the Haviyach HaShem HaLakech HaLa'oretz, is the 5,708th pasuk in the Torah. That is the year when the present state of Israel was established, which may mean, I mean, like this, that Eber strongly stated, like this, you have people who claim it's a chalted geula, and that Eber said it's not, it's just another stage of Golos, but apparently maybe the idea is that it was meant to be, somehow or other, a time of geula. Like this, if we had been zoichater, it would have been the geula amitis rashlema. Like this, all we have instead is a state that unfortunately is constantly under attack from then until now. But anyway. Then we have the second time, getting back to the sikha, is we have in Parshas Balak. Yeah, the Bilam's last nevuah. The Kum Shevet Yisrael, they'll rise up a staff, meaning a leader from among the Jewish people, the Karkau Kol B'nei Sheis, and they'll dominate over all the descendants of Sheis, meaning all of humanity, because Adam had three sons, Cain, Hevel, and Sheis, right? But Hevel died childless, and Cain and all of his descendants were wiped out in the marble. So everybody nowadays alive is descended from Sheis. So Kol B'nei Sheis means the entire humanity. So that means, in other words, that there's going to be a Jewish leader who's going to rule over all of humankind. That shows that there's going to be not just that there's going to be a geula, but it's going to be through Mashiach. Then you have the third time is in Parshas Shoftim. We have a mitzvah to have the six Ori Miklat. Somebody killed the Shoge, which is the topic in Shlosha Perakim of Rambam these days. Then he runs away to one of the Ori Miklat. And the Torah adds, V'im Yarchav Hashem Alekecha as Dvocha, when Hashem expands your borders and adds you the lands of Keni, Knezi, and Kadmoni, then you're going to add three more cities. Keni, Knezi, and Kadmoni, the Gemara in Baba Basra actually has a few different opinions what they are. The most well-known opinion is that they are the lands of Ammon, Moab, and Edom, in which case those are mostly in Jordan, maybe some of them in Saudi Arabia. The Gemara does bring a few other opinions that place them in various places in Syria or Turkey or Iraq or whatever. Yeah. I guess, yeah. Anyway, so that means, so then we have, so there's a mitzvah to build the three Ari Miklat, meaning, in other words, that we have a third point, that we also have, not only that there's going to be a Geula, not only that it's going to be the Mashiach, but that it's definitely going to happen, as we have the Eibishter gives a mitzvah, and as the Rambam says, the Eibishter doesn't give a mitzvah for nothing. Continuing on Halachas of Muktzah, there's something called Tzilto Kala'acha Yad, where you're moving something, but not in the normal way. Normally, you pick up something with your hand. So here, for example, we're talking about, let's say, moving with your foot. So you're allowed to do that with Muktzah. So, for example, you left something Muktzah accidentally on top of something, or something fell, Muktzah thing, fell in a place on Shabbos, and you need that space, or you need the keli that's underneath it, or whatever, you're allowed to, like, shake it, or you're allowed to, for example, pick up the keli and shake off the Muktzah someplace else, or just shake it off right there, as the case may be, or whatever. An example the Mishnah gives is, let's say, for example, you left money on a pillow. So you can shake the pillow and shake the coins off, or pick up the pillow and then carry it someplace else and shake it off, whatever. Actually, the Alter Rebbe says, to be exact, if you can shake it out where you are, then you have to do that. Don't carry the muktzah any more than necessary. If you can't, let's say you're going to shake it off over here, it's going to break or something, then you're allowed to take it someplace else. Same thing would be, for example, you leave money or something else muktzah in your pocket, and you need to wear that piece of clothing on Shabbos. You can't do it just for the sake of the muktzah. In other words, you can't do it just to save the muktzah, just only when you need the object that the muktzah is on top of or interfering with or whatever. Now, one more point is if you put the muktzah thing there deliberately before Shabbos, that's a whole different thing. Then the thing is called a bosses l'davar osur. That's another category of muktzah. Then you'd be osur to move it at all. For example, you have your Shabbos licht on the table, then the table itself becomes a bosses l'davar osur, unless, as we'll learn eventually when we get to it, Be'ez Hashem, if you have something else of value that's on the table that's not muktzah, for example, you put your chalas or something on the table before Shabbos. But here, for example, you deliberately place the money in this on this pillow before Shabbos, then yes, the pillow itself would be also to move on Shabbos.